Hey, everybody. Eric Trexler here with Mass Office Hours. On behalf of the Mass Research Review, I am here with the good Dr. Mike Zordos. His episodes always do very well. We usually get a very lively chat going on YouTube here with a lot of training-related questions. So I'm going to dive right into our first segment here. But before I do that, I got to get some stuff out of the way, if you'll indulge me, Mike. First of all, if you like the show, maybe you've heard it before, maybe this is your first time, there's a few ways that you can support the show, which would be very much appreciated on our end. You could like, rate, subscribe, and review wherever you get this podcast, / YouTube show. We're live on YouTube every Wednesday, but we post the replays a few days later on all your favorite podcast platforms. So like, rate, subscribe, review, tell a friend. That's the second way you can help. Send them a link to our YouTube, our Spotify page, our Apple Podcast page. You can submit a question. So we have the, there's a link in the description of this YouTube video that takes you to a submission portal where you can ask us questions 24/7, 365. That portal is always open. We're always checking it for new questions to answer on the show. But of course, the best way to ask a question and the best way to support the show is to simply participate live on YouTube. So we're here every Wednesday night at 7 p.m. Eastern time. That is going to change soon, folks. This happens twice a year, and it's always chaotic. We're about to have a time change on the Eastern Standard Time. I forget if we're going to daylight time, or I think we're going to daylight time. But anyway, if you're in one of those time zones that doesn't do the whole shifting time zone thing, this will impact you. But if you're shifting with us, you won't care. It'll all be the same. It'll just probably be a little bit lighter outside when you're joining us. So the time change is coming up, and we're sticking with 7 p.m. whenever 7 p.m. is. All right, so Mike, we had an episode a few weeks ago that you were on, and it was an instant classic, a fan favorite. And basically, Lauren and I got a bunch of questions about different training strategies, and I said, I'm going to let Mike handle this because he is the renowned expert in our crew when it comes to those different training strategies. Well, I'm going to lean on you again here because we've been getting a lot of questions about different approaches to progression in terms of resistance training. So different kind of progression strategies or progressive overload strategies. And it's one of our kind of common themes of questions, I guess. And so you stepped up to the plate, and you offered to kind of walk us through a bit of a guide on progressive overload strategy. So I'm going to hand over the floor to you.
Well, I appreciate that. You know, it was a good episode. People are saying perhaps the best episode. I don't know, you know, who specifically, but people are saying that. So if you're out there and you hear it, it's not unfounded. Mm-hmm. That's the number one episode of Office Hours so far. But we'll see if we can top it tonight. So, Trex, I'm going to talk about progressive overload strategies here. If you are able to, sir, there's a document I put together for the folks.
Absolutely.
Are we able to bring that up? If you go ahead and cover yourself up so it's just me and the document, that I think that's what people would enjoy the most.
Yep, I'm on it, and I'm going to mess with all the size stuff while you're talking, so you got it, man. Go ahead.
There we go. All right, well, for everyone here, because we've been getting some questions about progressive overload, and I've written this in Mass a few times, I did want to put together a document here and lead the show with it tonight, because when we talk about progressive overload, you know, years ago, I think people thought of this just in terms of increasing the load on the barbell or adding 2.5 kilograms, 5 pounds a week, or 5 kilos, roughly 10 pounds a week. However, this concept has progressed considerably for the better over the past 10 to 15 years. And instead of just thinking of progressive overload in terms of load specifically, we are now thinking of progressive overload in terms of adding sets or adding reps. And it's important to address when these strategies are appropriate, the different ones, what circumstances someone may want to use this or that. It's important to discuss that we can't progress load every week, nor should we try to do that. And so I want to get into these and ultimately talk about things that are actionable. So if we take a look at this document here, Progressive Overload Strategies, Specific Ways to Achieve Progressive Overload, and Actionable Guide. So these general notes at the top are just kind of what we talked about. And I'll summarize these briefly now, which are, there are so many different ways to achieve this progressive overload. And when we get into them, though, we're going to see kind of not only how to use them, but what I want to do is outline all of these ways. When we outline them, we'll be able to then see when things might apply to you. For example, if you're a powerlifter and you have a competition coming up next week, the strategies that you're going to want to use in a peaking block probably aren't going to be to add a bunch of sets as your method of progressive overload. It's more likely going to be to add weight to the barbell and to probably auto-regulate the way you're adding that weight to the barbell, because at that point you need to increase the load because that's the primary variable that's driving strength. So there isn't necessarily a right or wrong way overall, but there are times where one strategy or another is more appropriate. Now, that being said, if we scroll down and we see strategies to discuss here on the bottom of the first page, I've split out how I want to look at this tonight in terms of pure load progression strategies. And so there's three here that we're going to look at. And then ways to progress load where we intertwine load progression with set progression or load progression with rep progression. And I think that's a really important point, because oftentimes we tend to look at these things in kind of a binary fashion, right? Saying, well, should we increase reps or should we increase load? And there have been two recent studies that I've looked at this and essentially found that there hasn't been difference, one in beginners and one in a little bit more well-trained individuals, from progressing reps and progressing load. But just because there isn't a difference in one study doesn't mean there aren't times where we shouldn't stress one option versus another option. So as we go through these, let's discuss first these load progression strategies in isolation, then go down to intertwining them. So the load progression strategies in isolation, pre-planned or predetermined progressions, progression based upon the previous week's performance of repetitions in reserve or velocity, and then progression based upon a plus set. We'll make these very, very actionable and talk about the limitations of each of them as well. So if we go down to page 2, load progression in isolation here, pre-planned absolute or percentage progression. So first, what's our explanation or definition of what we're looking at here? Well, a pre-planned progression is just as it sounds. It's just simply adding a pre-planned load or percentage each week of a training block. So this, at first glance, you might say, well, why are we talking about this? We have all of these tools now. We have auto-regulation. We have RIR. We have velocity. We have maybe coaches' feedback from video analysis, all of these things. Why are we talking about just a pre-planned old school progression? I'll give some examples of when I actually think this might be pretty useful in just a moment. But what this is we set out our training block, and the first week of the training block, we have the load we're using. And we say, all right, we're just going to increase 2.5 kilograms per week, or we're going to increase 5 kilograms per week. And we just go ahead and do that. Now, if you look at bullet point 2 under the example, it's probably a bit better to use a percentage increase of the weight on the barbell. So whatever weight you have on the barbell, if you're lifting 100 kilos, to make the number simple, if you're going to increase 2.5%, then you'd increase 2.5 kilograms. But the reason being is a 2.5 kilogram increase is 1.4% for somebody lifting 175 kilograms, but it's 3.3% for somebody lifting 75 kilograms. So whenever we talk about progressive overload strategies, if we just give exact numbers and these absolute numbers, it's not going to apply across the board in that same manner, because a person that is lifting 75 kilograms, they increase 2.5 kilos, they might stall out more quickly than somebody lifting 175 kilograms. Now, they could just be more of a beginner, and so they're able to progress for longer, but they could also just have a really, really light body weight, and relatively, they're pretty strong, and they're going to stall out soon. So increasing a pre-planned load or percentage, a pre-planned percentage of the weight on the barbell. Now, I have, when is this applicable and the limitations on the document here? Let's skip to the limitations first, because I think those are pretty obvious, which is that this isn't auto-regulated. It's not taking into account individualization. It's not taking into account previous week's performance, and it's not taking into account the fluctuations in day-to-day energy levels. all of the reasons that the good Dr. Helms and I kind of have a career, right? We started talking about these things a while back and so forth. And many others, of course, have talked about them as well. So why am I on here talking about a pre-planned progression, which isn't taking into account autoregulation at all? Well, I still think this has merit. And I think it has merit sometimes in novice individuals. If I'm training a novice individual and they're just getting into it, they're not really training very close to failure, at least in how I like to utilize training in novices, especially if they're using a squat or bench press skilled technique. We're not having too much weight on the barbell. We're keeping it very light. We're working on technique. So if we're starting with really high RIRs, right, five or above, something like that, that's really easy. I know with confidence we can progress the load pretty simply for a little while and keep that linear progression. And one of the reasons in novices I like to do that is because I think if you get into the habit of using some autoregulation techniques, you might actually increase the load too much. You might say, oh, wow, this is really, really easy. They're progressing so fast. Let's put more on the barbell. And I'm not sure that's necessary in novice individuals. A couple other ways this could be effective for some people is, again, starting with the very high RIR. But if you go down to the third bullet point under when is this applicable, is that I think in some situations, some individuals may just want to kind of take the guesswork out of it. They may just want to have something down on the paper. They see it, they go do it, they don't have to question anything. And now, of course, this has the limitations. So I'm not here advocating this for everyone, but this is kind of strategy one. It's very simple, it's very straightforward. Somebody could do that. The other limitation of this is, of course, you're not going to be able to increase the load on the barbell every week forever. And we know that, and you shouldn't try to force it. And there are some ways around that even in this strategy. You could pre-plan a deload every 4 weeks as well. Start back when you come back from the deload, maybe where you were in week two or week three of the previous block, and then increase from there. But a pre-planned progression. The limitations, of course, though, as we said, as we scroll down to the next page, are that it's not taking into account any sort of autoregulation, any sort of previous performance. So if you recall, now we are looking at just load progression strategies before we get to intertwining load with other ways to achieve progressive overload. And there were three of them. The second one is progression based upon RIR, repetitions in reserve, or velocity. Now, the explanation here is pretty straightforward, which is you're increasing load for a session based upon the previous weeks or sessions, RIR, or velocity. So essentially, the point of this being is to correct for the mistakes or the limitations of that pre-planned progression. And so in this discussion, I'm going to focus on repetitions in reserve rather than velocity, because fundamentally they're accomplishing this a similar thing. One is subjective RIR and one is objective velocity. But most people have, I say, will probably use RIR more in practice just because of the accessibility of it. That being said, if you have questions on maybe specific velocity values to shoot for, go ahead and ask them, and I'll do my best off the top to answer them. But if you're taking a previous week's performance, now this is correcting for some of the limitation of the pre-planned load. Because you can say, all right, I had this RIR target, right, before we get into the table that's on the document here. And in this RIR target the previous week, I was shooting for an RIR of 2. Well, my RIR was 4. I was way stronger than I anticipated. So, all right, I'm going to go ahead and increase the load on the barbell for the next week. Or my RIR was 1, right? I was overshooting that RIR. I was too close to failure for what I was desiring to train to that week. So I'm going to go ahead and pull back the load, or maybe I'm going to keep the load the same for the following week. And any time that you have to, that you decrease the load or you keep the load the same, a lot of people have a difficult time doing that. And I understand that impulse, but the problem isn't that you couldn't increase the load. The problem is that you were training with a load that was too heavy in the first place to meet the goal that you had set out for yourself. So if you set out for yourself to do a bunch of sets of 5 at a 2 RIR, and you do a bunch of those sets to 5 with the load you have to failure or to a 1 RIR, the issue isn't that you can't increase the load for the following week. The issue is that you are lifting too heavy. So what you're getting from this RIR, this velocity, is good information. And you're using that information to make the adjustment. So if we look at a specific example, we can see the table here. So let's just say somebody's squatting for four sets of eight for 140 kilograms with a target RIR of 3 to 5. Well, if they're training there, we can see over here in the left-hand column of the table, the target RIR, I've made 4 because that's right in the middle of the 3 to 5 range, right? If the actual RIR was 5, that means they have 5 reps in reserve when they really only needed to have 4 reps. So we're going to get a pretty decent load increase of plus 5 kilograms. If they met their target, they take a smaller load increase. If they just missed the middle of the range, but they got a 3 RIR that's in that 3 to 5 range that they had, they can say no change, or they could increase load a little. And if they have much fewer repetitions in reserve than intended, they're probably going to want to keep the load the same or maybe even decrease the load. So essentially, it's pretty straightforward, but it's just basing that upon what happened the previous week's performance. Now, before we kind of go down to this, there's a couple other points that I want to make here, and we're going to see this kind of in the next table, which is, well, if you're doing, you know, multiple sets, 3, 4, 5 sets of something, and when I say RIR, what exactly am I talking about? Is that the RIR of which set? Typically, the way to use this would be the RIR of either the last set or the average RIR over all of the sets that you do. So if you're doing that 4 sets of 8 at 140 kilograms, you could look at the average, but I might probably maybe just look at the last set and say, all right, as long as that last set is within that range, whatever that last RIR is, that's what I'm going to use to plug into this table. The second point I want to make, and I've written this on the guide a few times, so as we're scrolling, you may see it, which is all of the numbers I'm throwing out here tonight are just simply conceptual, right? So you don't have to take this and say, ah, well, you know, Zordo said, when I hit that middle of that RIR target range, or I have one more RIR than intended, I increase the load 5 kilograms. Not at all. This is just a conceptual guide to say, hey, in general, if you're going to use RIR or velocity to progress load for the next week or for the next session, and you are right on target, 2.5 to 5 kilos is a decent concept. And so you can make these numbers a little bit different. They're going to apply to different RIRs. You could use an RIR range of 1 to 3. In that case, 2 would be your sweet spot for increasing load. 3, you would definitely increase load, and so forth. So these are just conceptual numbers. Nobody should take these exact numbers and say, hey, we have to do this. As we scroll down here, just a touch to the next two bullet points in the table, you can see that, again, I've said that instead of increasing an absolute amount of kilos, you might increase a percentage just to make sure it applies to all strength levels. And then in this other table here, which is going to do the same thing that we did on the smaller table above, it says it can also use day-specific progression. What I mean by that is if somebody, let's just say, to make it easy, I use an example of somebody squatting 3 times per week. Now, that is a high frequency, right? A lot of people won't be squatting 3 times a week. Maybe they're doing a specific exercise only once per week or maybe twice per week. But just to illustrate this concept, in this example, they're doing the same exercise 3 times per week. They have 4 sets of 8 on Monday, 4 sets of 6 on Wednesday, and 4 sets of 4 on Friday. And the reason I use those different rep ranges is to illustrate that some individuals may be better at moderate to high reps than they are at lower reps, or vice versa. So what I would do is, if you're using RIR to progress from 1 week to the next, just use Monday's RIR or Monday's velocity to progress load for that next Monday. Use Wednesday for the next Wednesday and Friday for the next Friday in this example, because there's different reps. So for example, if we look at the table and we see here over those 4 sets of 8 on Monday, over the sets, the goal target RIR was 3 to 5. The individual got within that range. They got 5 on the first set and then 4s and then 3. So they made a load increase. The same thing on Wednesday. But if we go down to Friday, they performed really well. So depending on how you perform, in this case, all right, They performed great. Their target RAR on Friday was 1-3, but they had actually 4 RAR and then all threes. So they're actually over the range on one of them. So they took a 5-kilogram increase that day and a 2.5-kilo increase on the other days. So this individual was a bit better at lower reps than they were at higher reps. So they used that specific information to progress those accordingly. So when you go do the same thing with velocity, right? So I know I said if you had any questions on this, go ahead and ask them. I'll do my best off the top to answer. But let's say, for example, somebody's using a last rep velocity and they wanted to go ahead and complete, you know, a certain number of repetitions before they hit 0.40 meters per second. Well, depending on the number of repetitions that they got, that they could use that to go ahead and increase the load. Or at the end of that set, let's say their velocity, they had a target velocity of 0.40. At the end of the set, the velocity was 0.44. So they were a bit stronger. They had a bit more repetitions in reserve. They would take a higher load increase. If their velocity was only 0.35, that's below the 0.40 target. In that case, they might keep the load the same. And so velocity is individual as well. So not everybody's going to apply to all of those specific velocity values, but that's how to use it. So at this point, there's kind of one more thing on the load progression I want to get to. But the main limitation of this last one, if we go with the RAR, is that RAR is subjective. And so who shouldn't use this? Well, somebody who is really off with their repetitions and reserve ratings, because the rating is only as useful as it is accurate. So if somebody is 3-4 reps off with their rating, that's not even close. And then they could say, hey, I have 4 RAR when they really have 1. Now, the question is, and this is a bigger concept, so I won't spend too much time on it, which is how accurate do RAR ratings need to be useful? And I would argue in some circumstances, they don't need to be perfectly accurate. They could be within one rep and you should be okay. In some circumstances, if you're trying to perform a single at as a 1 RAR a week out from testing strength, they do need to be really accurate. But in volume work, they can probably be off by about a rep or so. And so when is this applicable? Various goals, both strength, both muscle growth, you're auto-regulating based upon your previous week's performance. And I think that should be beneficial. So this rectifies the limitations of the pre-planned absolute or percentage progression. So we covered the pre-planned progression and we cover the RAR or velocity progression based upon previous week's performance, kind of opposed there in terms of one being fixed and one being auto-regulated. There's one more load progression I want to get to, which is essentially progressing based on a set to failure, an AMRAP set or a plus set. But I want to pause there for just a moment and see if Dr. Trexler thinks I need to clarify anything before we continue on in this load progression discussion.
I don't believe so. I was typing away, adjusting some things in one of the tables here, but we are on the same page. I think you're doing a great job explaining this stuff, and I'm excited to get to the next part where we start intertwining after we discuss the third strategy or the third approach.
Sounds good. So the third approach here would be to utilize what I call a plus set or an as many reps as possible set. And so, you know, oftentimes, especially for strength, because, you know, more so than hypertrophy for strength, we're most likely not going to be training to failure all of the time. And so in this case, somebody might have a prescription in which they're doing 3, 4, 5 sets of 4, sets of 3, something like that. But that last set, they're going to failure. And on that last set, depending on how many reps that they get, is the increase in load that they're going to take for the following session or for the following week. And that's what we have in the explanation here just under the heading, increasing load for session or week based upon performance on that plus set, that last set to failure. And so let's just say in the example here, somebody's bench pressing twice per week and they have a Tuesday and Friday. And on Friday, that second session, they're doing 4 sets of 4 plus. So 4 sets of 4 with that last set to failure. Well, based upon how many reps they get, they're going to go ahead and make the progression. That's pretty straightforward, right? Meaning the fewer reps they get, the lower the progression is going to be. The more reps they get, the greater the progression. So you can see in the table here, 4 to 5 reps, kind of right about where they were supposed to. They get a smaller increase in load or maybe keep the same load. And then that scales with getting more reps up to a pretty large increase with 10 reps. You can see here in this table, anytime I give an absolute value, such as 2.5 kilogram increase with 6 to 7 reps, I also give a percentage change. So if you were extrapolating this for yourself, I'd probably go with the percentage change because I don't know your strength level, and the percentage change should be more applicable across the board. Now, in theory, this should be pretty good because as you go through a training block, especially if you're focusing on strength, you should be getting stronger. So, all right, if I do this set and I take it to failure and I'm getting more reps with the same load as the previous week or with more load than the previous week, all right, that's good evidence I'm getting stronger. So then I should take this large load progression so I can probably sustain that for the following week. However, one of the issues with this is that it doesn't take into account the day-to-day fluctuation. Because even if you say, all right, I got 8 reps on my plus set here, so I'm going to take this 5 kilogram increase, but you don't feel good the next week when you get into the gym, you have a lot of stress, a lot of anxiety, you didn't sleep well, you didn't eat enough, whatever it might be, then it doesn't take that into account. But I think the bigger issue with this is that when you do, and I think we've all done this, what do you do when you have 4x4 with a plus set or something like that, and those first few sets are all to like a 2 or a 3 RIR? Well, what we tend to do is on that last set, right, you get a little bit more amped up. You get your favorite song queued up. You turn it up a little bit louder. You're getting jacked up with your buddies. If you are a mass subscriber, you'll know that this month, I just had an article come out that was titled, I believe, What's the Best Way to Get Jacked Up for Training? You're using some of those strategies in there. And then you perform really, really well on that plus set, probably over the capabilities that you perform in a state of normal excitability. So now you're basing your progression on a single set in which your excitability or arousal was much higher than normal. And it might be an inappropriate load progression for everything you're going to do in the following week. So I'm not always a huge fan of that style of progression. I like having the plus set because I think people like things that are quantifiable. I know that I do, and I can see my progress, but I wouldn't always apply it kind of just blanketly to the following week because of those limitations of using that plus set to progress performance. So those are the three strategies I put in here to progress load. And again, I say this at the end too, this obviously isn't a comprehensive guide. These aren't the only ways for somebody to be able to progress load. But if I did keep going on, because I still have 2 more things to get to, then Trex wouldn't get to talk at all this episode. And while I know that would be nice for the viewers, it would make him a little bit sad. And I want to stay on good terms since he is the host.
Absolutely. And it's worth noting, on that note, you know, we're not covering every possible thing about progressive overload here. We're focusing on load progression specifically. So like, I'm sure some people are thinking, well, wait a minute, why don't I just add a couple reps here and there or add another set to my workout? So those are certainly instances of progressive overload if you're adding reps or you're adding sets. But in this case, we're just kind of focusing on load progression, looking at one thing at a time.
Absolutely. And so, but it's the perfect time to throw that in here because we are now going to transition in the kind of second part here, as you can see at the top, into intertwining load, set, and rep progression. And to me, I think this is really cool because, again, there are a couple studies on this recently, and people often ask the question, and they look at this in a binary fashion. And I think that happens really far too often in our field where folks tend to look at things in a binary fashion. Should I do this or should I do that? And it's often doesn't have to be that choice, right? We've seen it over the past year or so with training to failure. Should I train to failure? Or should I not train to failure? You could do both, right? One of the questions on that is even if training to failure does offer benefit, as meta regression shows, the question is that I've always had is, well, how frequently do you need to train to failure, right? If 2 sets were going to failure, then that's a failure study technically in the analysis. But what if they did 5 sets? Did those 2 sets, you know, did they do the job? If somebody did 5 sets, would only 1 or 2 sets be needed to go to failure? So in this case, we don't need to look at progression, load, sets, or reps as a binary thing. We can actually intertwine them. And so if we look at the first thing here, we're going to talk about load progression tied to set benchmarks and load progression tied to rep benchmarks. So in this case, load progression tied to a set benchmark is simply just to say that, all right, we're not going to increase the load every single week. We might try to increase the number of sets we're doing, and then once we can do a certain number of sets with this load, and perhaps with this load to a certain number of RIR, then we're going to go ahead and increase the load on the barbell. And oftentimes, I think that's a really, really nice strategy, because it's just not possible to continue to increase load each week. But as Trek said just a few minutes ago, there are a number of other ways to be able to achieve progressive overload, to continue to place additional stressors on yourself, to try and go ahead and make that adaptation. And then remember, when you're progressing the load isn't giving you the adaptation. You've already made the adaptation, which is why you're going to progress load. So perhaps adding sets is a way to do that. So to give an example here, let's give an example of first into the bullet points before we get to the table. Somebody's bench pressing twice a week, four sets of eight with 85 kilograms. Well, they might continue doing this until they can do all of those sets at greater than or equal to a 2 RIR. Once they do that, that might take them 3 weeks. And then once they can do that at a greater than or 2 RIR for all of the sets, then they may increase the load to 87.5 kilograms, right? Or maybe they bench press 2 times a week, start at 3 sets of 8 with 85 kilos, add a set each time they're benching. And then once they can complete, they reach 5 sets and they can do all 5 sets at greater than or equal to 2 RIR, they go ahead and increase the load, right? So the table shows us kind of a similar concept, and it does so in a kind of a specific day progression strategy. So again, you don't have to perform these lifts with a frequency of 3 times a week, but it makes it very simple to demonstrate from a teaching perspective, which is why I have it fleshed out that way here. So Monday, Wednesday, Fridays, somebody's squatting, and you can see on Monday, all right, 3 sets of 8 at 70%. We'll just focus on the Monday column for now, 140 kilograms. The last set RIR is 1. On the top of the table, we're looking to increase sets until we get to 5 sets, and we can do all of them at a greater than or equal to 1 RIR, then we increase load. Week 2, we're going to 4 sets. Last set RIR is 1. The next week, the third row for Monday, we get to 5 sets, but that RIR is 0. So what happens? We got to do 5 by 8 again. We go to the next week, it's 1 RIR. And as we scroll down to the next page, we can see ultimately when we get to week 4 of this training program, the goal was met. So since the goal was met, we're going to increase the load from 140 to 142.5 kilograms and decrease the sets from 5 back to 3. So essentially, we're looking to say, all right, we start at 3 sets of 8, 140 kilograms for this individual. We're increasing sets every time we can do all of those sets to a 1 RIR or more RIR. Once we get to 5 and we can do that with 5, then okay, we're going to increase the load. But because we're now increasing the load, we're going to drop the sets so we're not having too many changes at the same time, make sure it's feasible, and then go through the process again. So just a way to tie load progression to set progression. If you're feeling, I can't increase load every week, trust me, you're not alone. And if you haven't felt that way yet, if you're a bit newer to training, enjoy it. It's phenomenal to go in the gym those first kind of beginning of your training career and just really be able to crush it. But trust me, the day is coming when you can't quite increase the load each week, and strategies like this will be quite beneficial. Now, the one limitation of this, which isn't necessarily a limitation, it's just this is where I say that, all right, although there isn't a right or wrong way and all of these strategies can be beneficial, there are specific times where this or that strategy may not be the best way to go, which is, and I gave this example earlier, somebody is, you know, in a peaking block for a powerlifting meet to test their strength. You're probably not looking to increase sets, increase that volume substantially within a couple weeks before you're going to go ahead and test that strength. So in that case, you're probably looking to increase load via one of the strategies we looked at earlier, maybe RAR or velocity-based autoregulation. In this case, the tying the load to the set progression probably isn't the way to go if you're looking to peak strength. But otherwise, powerlifters and volume blocks, general trainees, bodybuilders, I think this is a great way to go. And for bodybuilders especially that are looking to increase volume, you know, they don't need to be so concerned, or just individuals interested in muscle growth don't need to be so concerned about increasing the load on the barbell. Now, if you always increase reps and you're getting into 20, 30, 40 reps, eventually load increases are going to be necessary for those reasons. But I think this is a great strategy for a lot of folks to be able to use. And then the last thing that we kind of have on the document here is very, very similar to what we just looked at. But instead of load progression being tied to a set benchmark, on the next page here, we have a load progression being tied to a rep benchmark. And so essentially, once you can do a certain number of reps across all of these sets, then you go ahead and increase the load. So if we look at our example here, somebody could squat, let's say, 3x8 with 140 kilograms or any prescription, and could add reps each week until all the sets are completed with 10 reps. So that's our starting point. And we say, all right, we're going to go ahead and say, all right, next week, perform some more reps. That could be to failure. That could be to say, once I can hit 10 reps all at a 1RAR or a 2RAR, whatever your goals are, whatever you're training for, however you like to do it, all of those are appropriate. And then once you meet that benchmark, then you say, all right, now I'm going to go to 142.5 kilograms. So kind of similar here to the other table. It's the same concept where we're just looking to go ahead and say, all right, how many reps did we get on that set? If we go to the Monday squat, we say 3 sets of 8 to 10 at 70% or 140 kilograms. Reps per set are all 8. So we didn't hit 10. So what do we have to do? We have to keep going. If we stay in that Monday column just to use that day specific progression, you can see the next week reps of 9, 9, 8. The next week reps of 10, 10, 9. And then finally in the next week, it's all sets were of 10. So then, all right, we're going to increase the load, 3 sets of 142.5 kilograms. Limitation similar to the last one, probably not what somebody's going to do just before they're testing strength, because they're looking to increase load at that point because load is so closely tied to strength gains. But another very, very viable strategy showing that we don't have to look at things in this binary fashion. Ultimately, as we kind of come to a close here on this, you know, the things that I want to get across about this is that these are all conceptual. It's not comprehensive. They're all conceptual. Don't take the exact values and think you have to use this. Create a completely different chart that you think applies to you. You know how yourself, or if you're a coach, how your lifters tend to be able to progress, meaning that you know, all right, 2.5 kilos tends to be a bit much for them, or 5 kilos tends to be a bit much for them, or they're really good at reps. So since they're really good at reps, I'm going to go ahead and make this adjustment to some of those protocols. Make your own progression tables. Utilize them. What research does and what these things do is they give us concepts and they give us ideas. But there's no study that's out there that's saying you have to progress exactly this much, or if you get this many reps on a plus set, you have to progress this way. That doesn't exist, and it's not going to exist, right? So these are concepts that we have, we could take, we disseminate them, and then coaches and lifters probably know how to use these concepts much better than the scientists. So take these, adapt them for yourself, and put them into practice. And the last thing, although I've said it earlier a few times tonight, is when you, then this is really difficult. This is really difficult for everybody that's training, because we just can't help ourselves. It's the kind of, you know, do what I say, not what I do type of thing. But when you're going in the gym and you know that you're not feeling good and you know you shouldn't be progressing load, you know that that 75 kilo bench press for 3 sets of 10 was really hard last week, but you had it planned, you were going to go to 77.5 kilos in week 3, you know you shouldn't do it, but you do it anyways. It never ends well. It always ends poorly. Try to resist the urge to force yourself to increase load when you know you shouldn't. And if you can't, try and use one of the rep or the set progression strategies, right? They will give you the feeling of achieving some sort of progressive overload without forcing that in there. So I hope going through all of these was beneficial for everybody. Again, just conceptual guides, but hopefully it's actionable and you can put it into practice.
That was fantastic. And I just want to echo what you were saying about, you know, those times where we've all been there when you want to bump up the load a little bit. You kind of know that you shouldn't, and then you do anyway. I used to always tell my clients, because you've got some clients who are a little bit sheepish or a little bit timid about bumping loads. Then you've got other clients who are just reckless, right? And this is the message I would give the reckless ones, and it's that you really can't gain all that much in one workout, but you can lose a ton in one workout. You know what I mean? Like when you're really flirting with that line of doing reckless things that are totally inadvisable, I never want to plant the, I don't want to like nocebo anyone into a state where they're afraid to train and afraid to train hard. But, you know, it's a reality of lifting. I mean, you can look at the metrics objectively. If you lift long enough, you're going to run into some injuries from time to time. And the best way to run into more injuries sooner and more frequently is to be really reckless with your load progression, you know? And so I would always tell my clients, like, we shouldn't be afraid to lift. I'm not trying to, you know, plant any negative ideas in your head, but, you know, the message rings true. You can't really gain all that much in a single workout, but if you are, you know, being totally reckless and you get an injury that, you know, causes you to take it easy for 4 weeks, you've lost quite a bit in that one workout, you know, and sometimes it's even more than 4 weeks, which is where you really start to lose a lot there. You can get it back, but we're training, right? We're not in the business of being out for 4 to 6 weeks, right? If we can avoid it.
That's actually a great thing you said at the end. I always pose the question again. I'm not saying I'm good at this. I'm terrible at this, right? So I'm probably not the best messenger, but when you said we're in the business of training, we're not being in the business of being out for 4 to 6 weeks. So I always pose to folks, if you're nicked up a little bit or you know you should increase the load, do you want to take a day off or do you want to take a month off?
Yeah.
You know, if you are in the middle of rewatching Breaking Bad and you got a lot of episodes to catch up on, maybe you want to take a month off. I get it. Right? You got to catch up. But I'd rather take a day off. And I, from being someone who has made that mistake almost every time from the years of, and I'm going to date myself and people are going to say, well, you're almost as old as Helms. You shouldn't be making fun of him so much. I'm not going to stop. And then from the years of 2003 to 2019, and that's a long time, almost every single time I was presented with that choice, I chose, I'll be fine. And guess what? Almost every time I ended up having to take a month off. And so I would really stress to everybody out there to do that. And even if you didn't need to back off a little bit, it's not going to hurt.
Yeah.
It's not going to hurt at all.
Yep. Absolutely. Well, I tell you what, Mike, we should dive into the chat here and give some love to the folks who are here with us live. They are literally the lifeblood of this show. They make it worthwhile. They make it worth doing. We are so appreciative of them for joining us live on YouTube every Wednesday night. We got the hashtags rolling in, of course. Zordopamine is a classic. Trextopia is a classic. We got a few Trex Nations in there. There's one that I'm not enjoying, and I'm going to go ahead and put a ban on it. So an official moratorium. It will never show up again in the chat. If it does, there will be consequences. Someone put the hashtag Trex offenders. Now, I don't like the connotation, so that one is off the list. Okay, so Conrad Cronin in there in the chat, never again, or you may get permanently banned from being in the chat. I hate to say it. All right, we got some questions, Mike, about exercise and nutrition and stuff like that. So one question from Art is on the topic of stretch-mediated hypertrophy, which is exactly what it sounds like. It seems like with forced stretching, you can induce some degree of muscle hypertrophy. Lately, there's been some cool research that we have covered in Mass on things like, you know, pretty extreme calf stretching. I don't think it's published yet, but we've got a paper, an article coming about pec stretching as well, right? That should be coming up soon. So stretching seems to be inducing some hypertrophy, but Art said that when they're doing higher reps, like 15 and above, they really don't feel much of a stretch in the target muscles, especially with isolation exercises. And so they're wondering if stretch-mediated hypertrophy is attenuated with the use of lighter loads. So I am going to chime in, throw my two cents. I would say I don't believe so. I would be very skeptical of that, mainly because some of the studies that we look at showing stretch-mediated hypertrophy, they are essentially unloaded, right? I mean, technically, there is an isometric load on the muscle fibers because there's a stretch going on, but it doesn't seem to be the type of thing where you need to have any kind of really heavy load. So I wouldn't expect that, adding more weight is going to necessarily be beneficial for specifically stretch-mediated hypertrophy. The only exception, I guess, sometimes, depending on the exercise, people notice that they end up being kind of forced into a greater range of motion when they use a heavier weight, sometimes if I'm just doing like easy dumbbell bench presses warming up, I might have a slightly shorter range of motion. And then when I'm coming down with a really big load, it kind of, it basically is kind of squishing you down to the bench a little bit, getting a little bit extra stretch at the bottom. I really doubt it would be making a big deal related to stretch-mediated hypertrophy. Zoros, what do you think about that?
I don't have too much to add. I think that, one, it would be nice if we had some more data on that specifically to be able to make really, really strong claims. But I agree with Trex. I don't see that being attenuated with those lighter loads. I think the mechanism is still in play. And without evidence to suggest that the mechanism isn't still in play there, I wouldn't see that. I just don't see that being the case. That being said, hopefully we'll have some evidence to be able to support or refute that at some point.
Yeah. Here's one that's right up your alley, right in the wheelhouse, Mike.
Let's go.
We got a question. Some experts advise 3 hours a week of endurance exercise in heart rate zone 2. Can this be enough to cause the interference effect if done right after strength training 3 to 4 days per week? And what about if you add in another hour of high-intensity interval training on top of that if you're trying to increase your VO2 max? So two questions. We're doing our cardio after resistance training. We're doing it 3 to 4 days a week. Question one would be, how worried are you about doing 3 hours a week of zone 2 cardio? And then question two would be, same question, but what if we add in another hour of high-intensity interval training?
All right, there's a lot here. I feel that this could actually be an episode, so I'll do my best to distill it down to a couple minutes here. First, zone 2, for those out here that haven't become super small and weak like myself over the past few years, somebody who did some zone 2 today. Zone 2, we're looking at heart rates 120, 130 beats per minute to 150 beats per minute, probably max for most. Zone 1 would be lower than that. Then above that, you're looking at more of, getting closer to a lactate threshold type of run or type of workout. And then above that, you're getting into a VO2 max. So if you can think of that zone 2, what they call in the typical endurance world, kind of like the, fat oxidation type of point before you're getting into carbs. And then, past that lactate threshold, and then past that, or what some people call like tempo work, and then past that over to VO2 max. So a sustainable, can you talk, have a conversation, the old talk test type of deal during that workout. So that's a great thing to do for health, for cardiorespiratory system, and, increase your endurance capacity, increase aerobic fitness. Fantastic. But the question here is, can it cause the interference effect when done right after strength training 3 to 4 days per week? Well, first and foremost, if you're doing it 3 to 4 days per week, and we're saying 3 hours per week, then I'm assuming that this cardio is split up, but that's a lot. So maybe 45 minutes a time if they're going 4 days a week or so, about that. And if it's done right after, the And I'm going to take a second before giving a, hey, yes or no, which is, in general, and I've talked about this before on the show here, the interference effect is the interference, if you will, from a lifter's perspective. All of this cardio or all this aerobic exercise and it potentially not stopping gains in strength, power, and hypertrophy, but attenuating them. So they'll still occur, but they'll occur at a lower rate. And as I've said before, there's really, for the interference effect, it does exist, but it is a little bit harder to achieve than most people think. The dosage of aerobic exercise has to be really, really high. So if you're running 100 miles a week, it's going to exist. If you're running 10 miles a week and it's spread out, probably not a big deal. But the other factor in the interference effect is what this question is getting after, which is that ideally, resistance training and aerobic training should be split up by 24 hours or at a minimum, 4 hours. If this aerobic exercise is done immediately after, my questions would be, how long? Based upon this, I'm going to say it's about 45 minutes. It's going to be steady state. And then if it's after upper body exercise, I would say probably not too big of a deal. If it's after lower body exercise, I would say because of the proximity and the fact that it's longer, I can't give you a definitive answer. But if your goal is truly to maximize strength or hypertrophy or power, and you can avoid that, you can move it a few hours later or move it to the next day, I would. It doesn't mean it's crushing your strength. It doesn't mean it's crushing your muscle growth. I think if that causes the interference effect, it's probably fairly minimal because the intensity is low. But the duration is long enough. And really, it's the proximity to resistance training there that I don't like in terms of saying, I might shy away from that. So pressed to give an answer, I think I might shy away from that there. And then maybe another hour of HIIT for VO2 max. The question being, I think it'd be great to train your VO2 max. The question is, why do you want to train your VO2 max? If you're an aerobic athlete, maybe, although VO2 max isn't super related to performance, but VO2 max workouts are okay. And then if it's for the interference effect, I would say, when is the HIIT being done? If the high intensity interval training is being done immediately after resistance training, I wouldn't do it then. And I would keep it maybe 24 hours away from a lower body workout because that could cause some fatigue and some damage and so forth. But if you're just doing that mechanistically, that's pretty similar to resistance training. So I wouldn't be too worried about the interference effect there. So there's a lot there.
Yeah, good stuff. So the next question here is kind of back into more straightforward resistance training stuff. No cardio here. I hate to disappoint you, Zordos, but Wes asked, in specialization phases, how low should non-prioritized muscle volume go? So when you're really focusing on specializing in one lift or one particular muscle group, you know, what do you do with volume for the other muscle groups or the other lifts? And I can say from my experience, I used to be really into doing these specialization phases when I was competing in powerlifting. I really enjoyed just leaning all in on one exercise and pushing it as hard as I could. So with my other muscle groups or my other lifts, it would kind of depend. I would basically use gym time as a bit of an indicator, right? So I would get through my workouts and I'd try to make sure that my time per session and total training time per week ended up being fairly similar, mostly just out of convenience. Like for me, that was a very intuitive way to kind of manage my total training load a little bit. But practically what that would look like, you know, it would depend on exactly how much specialization I'm doing, right? It's one thing to say, hey, I'm going to focus a little bit more on bench press. And it's a different thing to say, hey, I've got 8 sets of bench heavy on Friday and 10 sets of bench heavy on Saturday, right? And doing, you know, 4 heavy days of bench per week, culminating in those big marathon sessions. When I was doing that type of training program, Smolov Junior is the one I'm referring to, or when I was doing Smolov, the base mesocycle for squats, honestly, some of my other muscle groups, the volume would be cut to a half or even a quarter of what I had been doing. And there were some muscle groups that I just said, hey, we're not training them, right? So like if you're doing Smolov Junior on bench, how much tricep and deltoid work do you really need? And how much do you how advisable would it be? Like, where are you going to put that in the week when you've got heavy bench on Monday and Wednesday and Friday and Saturday? I mean, aside from doing a couple lateral raises here and there, like, when are you going to sneak some overhead press in there in a way that's not going to detrimentally impact a bench press session, right? So it kind of depends on the muscle group. But yeah, sometimes I would not be shy about dropping my other volume all the way down to half or even a quarter of what I had been doing. You know, there is some research, particularly, I believe, in older folks indicating that they can maintain a surprising amount of their gains by dropping their volume all the way to a ninth of what they had been doing previously for a period of time. But I do, my intuition tells me that if you were at a higher training status, you probably wouldn't be able to get away with that same degree of volume reduction for a long stretch of time. I think the more trained, you know, it's just like anything else, right? Like when you are absolutely super well trained at the top of your game, you know, you kind of have more to lose from a little bit of a layoff from training. I expect that you have to probably put in a little bit more than a ninth of your volume to maintain what you've had. But Zordos, what do you think?
Let me split this out real quick to both strength and hypertrophy, because I think the answers are slightly different.
Oh, so, yeah, I should be clear. When I was talking about the layoff timing and stuff like that, I was mostly focused on hypertrophy with that answer. But yeah, go on. You're probably going to say what I would backtrack and say.
Yeah. So if we go, I'll take my answer for hypertrophy is very similar to Dr. Trexler. So if we go from the strength perspective, and somebody is doing the Smoloff Junior, which, by the way, I hit my all-time bench PR at the end of Smoloff Junior. Thank you very much.
I did,
and,
too.
There you go. There you go. And then did you run it back again immediately after?
So, no. Actually, what I did was I did it once, ran it right back, and then I hit my all-time PR. And then at that, I was like, I can't run it back a third time. That's crazy.
Yeah. If I think we've actually talked about this before, but for anybody who is not from the let's say 2008 to 2012-ish time of lifting, you know, what you did was you did this super high volume program, much more volume than you're ever doing. It works great because it's just super new. And then you think, I just gained 30 pounds on my squat. I'm going to do it again. Mm-hmm. And to nobody's surprise, it did not work, and you crashed and burned about 2 weeks in, and that was all she wrote on that one. So in their terms of this question, though, where would you kind of bring volume during these specialization phases or volume cycling phases on the muscle groups that aren't being prioritized? From a strength perspective, I think of some of Dr. Pack's minimal effective dose work, and I wrote about this in Mass here recently. And so what I mean is, it matters if your goal is to maintain strength, because Trex just took the hypertrophy route. It matters what the load is with how low you can drop the volume. So if you are prioritizing your lower body and you're doing a lot of squats, a lot of leg press, a lot of leg extensions, whatever it might be, and you still need to maintain your bench press if you're interested in strength, but you are doing, you know, 40 sets for quads a week and you're still training hamstrings and whatever it is, you might not have a lot of time or energy or effort to put into it. So in that case, I think you could go really, really low on the volume. Could work up to a couple singles, two singles at a one RAR twice per week, maybe one set of volume after each of them. You could probably do that for 6 weeks, and I think you'd be just fine on bench press. You from a pure strength perspective. Now, would you maybe lose some muscle in your upper body if you're not doing any assistance work? Maybe. But I think a way around that is, yeah, bench press takes a little bit more effort and focus than, you know, maybe some dumbbell work or some push-ups or some other things. So I'd probably get my volume in that way, and so forth, you know. And I've been through this, and I've done some really high volume work than the Smoloff, for example. But I've been through a couple stints, one of them where I max squatted 150 some days in a row. And some of those were twice a days. And let me tell you, the grocery store where I like to get this chicken tender sub always closed at a perfect time. And so I always had to decide, am I going to bench press today? after I just squatted for 3 hours, or am I going to go get that sub? And almost every single time I chose to go get that sub sandwich. But when I was bench pressing, I would keep that bench press volume very low. And I would do what I kind of just described twice a week, work up to a heavy-ish single, maybe one set of volume, and then I'd be done. If it's hypertrophy, I'd take a look at kind of the lower end of the general recommendations for trained individuals, 8 to 10 kind of sets per week for muscle group. That's not per exercise. That's not that much when you really think about it. And I think you can probably take that volume down to like 8-ish sets or so and be okay. And then it just kind of depends on the proximity to failure that you're taking them to. If failure does give you a little bit more, maybe you can take them down lower, take those couple sets to failure. For hypertrophy, you'd be okay. For strength, I'd probably keep it shy of failure. So I think you need a little bit more volume for hypertrophy than for strength. And for strength, you could get away with a very, very few sets. Just keep the load high.
Yep, absolutely. I agree. Got a couple quick questions here. So one is, on rest days, do you recommend complete rest or still incorporating cardio and or sauna for recovery? I don't think you need to add anything in for recovery's purposes. Like, I don't think a little bit of cardio or getting in the sauna is going to do all that much for you personally. But I don't think you need to rigidly avoid those things on an off day. I know sometimes people think, I'm taking an off day, you know, I need to be careful about walking too many aisles when I'm in the grocery store shopping, and it's just not the case, right? So off days can be arranged a lot of different ways. And I'll even go out on a limb and say you don't even necessarily need a total off day, right? Like, if you are taking an appropriate amount of total training and spreading it across 7 days, there are ways to do that very thoughtfully that leave you in a position where you don't actually need to have, you know, an entire off day each week. I think a lot of people, for a variety of reasons, it's beneficial for them, you know, just because it's to live a balanced life. Sometimes it's nice to just have a day where you're not obligated to, you know, pack up the car, go over to the gym and spend an hour away from whatever else you would have done. But yeah, I don't think there's anything wrong with cardio or sauna on an off day, as long as the cardio volume's within reason. But I don't think you really need it for recovery. What do you think, Mike?
Yeah, agreed. And the cardio specifically, I'm kind of a pessimist on some of the recovery modalities that are out there. And I always kind of say, if you always feel that you need extra recovery, then perhaps it's not the recovery that's the issue. It's perhaps that your training program needs adjusting. You're doing too much volume because you shouldn't always feel beat up. But in terms of cardio on an off day, cardio on an off day has actually been the one recovery metric that I haven't been so pessimistic on, because you know, going for a walk is something that people kind of, you know, are doing anyways. You could potentially ride an indoor cycle while you're, you know, watching television or doing something else. Low intensity should increase the blood flow and so forth. However, I did review some recent data in Mass that kind of said it might be a little effective, but not too much, which, you know, would probably make me lean toward what Trex is saying, which is, it's probably not going to do too much for you. I still think I hold out a little bit of hope for it, but probably not going to get much from it. Also, as he said, though, don't avoid it. It's not going to, as long as you're not going too intense where it's causing more fatigue and you want to go ride the bike for 20 minutes or want to go for a jog, and if it's an off day, that's the time to do it. And as far as Trex said something that's really important that I think is worth reiterating, which is, you may not need an off day, he said, if you organize your training appropriately, meaning that if you're going in the gym for 3 hours every day and just crushing it every set to failure, you should probably take an off day. But
probably
if you're
a couple.
Probably more than one.
Yeah.
But if you're organizing your training appropriately, you could probably get away with training every day. So I just think that's the distinction. He didn't say nobody needs an off day. Said if your training is organized appropriately, you could be okay.
Yeah, if you have a deltoid day and a bicep day, like, you can train every day, right?
Why wouldn't you?
Well, that's what I'm saying. You know, hey, go for it. You know, I had a buddy in college. I hope he doesn't know that we do this podcast, but he used to have a trap day, and to me that was like the epitome of taking your splits to the extreme, like to have a whole trap day. It was wild, man.
He sounds great. I hope he does listen to this podcast, and I would like to invite this this gentleman on as a guest on the next episode. So I have more questions.
He super great guy. I love that guy. Really funny. He and I at the time were both working as bouncers at a bar, and so like, if there's one profession that needs to have a dedicated trap day, it's the bouncer, you know, the security at a bar. You got to fill out the polo, and there's no better way to do that and look imposing as a security staff than just having enormous traps, you know?
No, that's the number one. That's the number one when somebody sees you. You know, if your shoulders are you know, into your chin or into your cheekbones, then, you know, you're in good shape.
Yeah, there's like, I don't need to know anything else about a person. If you tell me that they have huge traps and one or more cauliflower ears, don't mess with them. There's I don't care who you are. I don't care what you're built like. Just stay away. You have no idea what you're walking into.
They have some, they likely wrestled at some level in that case. And I'm staying on my feet.
Yeah,
that's the only way I can survive.
And the traps, if they're still big, it leads me to believe that someone is still hanging on their neck every now and then. So they're, it wasn't like 20 years ago that they're wrestling, you know, they still got it. All right. So that's what people come for, is the life advice on this podcast. And that is probably the most important advice you could get. All right. So we've got a question here. Really quick one. Mike, would you classify EMOM sets as cluster sets? So that's doing a set every minute on the minute. What would that fall into if you had to squeeze it into a category?
I would not classify those as cluster sets. Cluster sets are you know, much shorter. We're thinking of three sets of 10, a set of 10 where somebody's doing two reps, taking 20 seconds rest, doing two reps, 20 seconds rest, two reps until they get to 10. Then they're taking 3 minutes rest or whatever it is. Then they're doing the next set like that. So I wouldn't classify that as cluster sets. You know, there's two kind of ways to set up these EMOM sets. One is three sets on an exercise, you do a set, minute rest, do a set. That's just really short rest intervals. And if you're going to take short rest intervals, that's okay. But I'd probably add a set or two so you're not sacrificing too much volume when compared to long rest when set are equated. Longer rest seems to be more beneficial for strength and for hypertrophy. However, if you add sets to the short rest intervals, which you can do and still save time or do in the same time as long rest, you'll be fine. You won't compromise muscle growth most likely. The other way to do EMOM sets would be to maybe set it up like a circuit. So you have these six exercises and I'm going right from leg presses to shoulder presses to rows to lateral raises to curls to whatever. In that case, I think it's kind of more like a circuit, and I might structure them with agonist antagonist movements, you know, benches and then rows or something like that, so you're not too fatigued on all of them. But no, I would not consider them cluster sets. Maybe more similar to rest pause, but rest pause is shorter than that. So I think it's just short rest interval training. Really,
I hear you, man. Another training one here. Is there a difference in hypertrophy from concentric versus eccentric lifting, and does it make theoretical sense to prioritize one or the other? Again, just focused on hypertrophy here.
So you could make an argument that it makes theoretical, you can make an argument each way, but I think you can make an argument that it makes theoretical sense to focus on or to prioritize the eccentric. However, in practice, we do see limitations to that. And in the research, we see that both are contributing. And so there are some study that's showing when you do eccentric only, eccentric concentric and concentric only, that concentric only seems to be the only one that is a bit inferior. So I would be sure to do the eccentric. However, when you look in the literature, you can gain muscle through a variety of tempos. However, when the eccentric becomes too long and the duration is too long, then hypertrophy does seem to be sacrificed some. So I think the eccentric is quite important for hypertrophy. I wouldn't equate that with muscle damage driving hypertrophy. The jury is certainly out on that, because the eccentric does seem to cause a lot of damage. I would prioritize doing both, and I know this is not really going out on a limb, and keeping that eccentric controlled, making sure the eccentric isn't lasting too long. If you want to slow it down a little bit, especially on some single joint movements, I think that's totally fine. If I'm pinned down and say, hey, what's the only thing I definitely wouldn't do? If my whole goal was to grow muscle, the only thing in that kind of umbrella that I wouldn't do would be to only do the concentric and ignore the eccentric. That's the one I would say most confident is probably a little bit inferior, but I would do both.
Yeah, I agree. Got a couple questions about glycogen, so I'm going to take the microphone, take the steering wheel here, and address those. So one question was, is it bad to go to sleep with your glycogen depleted? It sounds like this individual has been doing some pretty tough workouts at night after dinner and then just going right to bed and dealing with food in the morning. There's absolutely nothing wrong with going to bed with glycogen depleted. And in fact, it's actually a strategy that has been used in the literature with a modest level of success. So the idea, and this is for people who are focused on endurance performance, there is a strategy called train high, sleep low. And it's kind of borrowing the terminology from altitude exposure, where people would talk about, you know, training low and staying high, where you kind of go up in at altitude and get accustomed to, you know, all the cardiovascular adaptations that occur when you've got a low partial pressure of oxygen. And then just for their training sessions, they would come down to kind of closer to sea level so that they weren't huffing and puffing and limiting their training volume when they were actually training. And people have tried all different iterations of that. But they kind of borrowed that terminology and brought it into the glycogen world. And the idea is you strategically time your carbohydrates so that you have plenty of glycogen for your training session and you deplete your glycogen. And then you just spend some time with low glycogen levels to kind of facilitate adaptations to increase, you know, your biochemical machinery for breaking down and metabolizing and utilizing fat. You know, so you're basically undergoing these mitochondrial adaptations from prolonged exposure to low glycogen, but you're making sure that you're not going into your workouts in a state of low glycogen. So it's just kind of strategic carb timing. And again, it's not going to make or break anyone's training, and it's specifically for endurance athletes. So for a lifter, it doesn't matter at all. For an endurance athlete, it actually can be used in a way that's somewhat advantageous to sleep with a little bit of glycogen depletion. The other question I saw about glycogen was, do high-velocity, high-power athletes need carbs to fuel performance for an optimal training session? And so there's a couple interesting wrinkles here. So if you really want to maintain high power output and high velocity of muscle actions, and it's a relatively higher volume workout, then you would certainly want to have plenty of carbohydrate. However, a lot of folks who do this type of high power training also tend to be on relatively low volume programs. And the second part of the question does kind of clarify that. So if high volume's not in the picture, then the question is, to what extent are we really talking about glycogen depletion here, right? So carb, you know, your carb intake and your relative degree of glycogen replenishment, you know, it's a matter of degrees, you know, and I would suggest that if you're on a power-focused training program that's very low volume, you probably don't need to be eating a ton of carbohydrate to fuel that effectively. However, I would not write off the possibility that extreme glycogen depletion could still impair your workouts. Because I think what we see from the carbohydrate rinse literature indicates that there is probably some kind of centrally mediated effect of having some degree of carbohydrate in the diet. And I also would say when you look at the kind of mechanistic view of the release of calcium from the sarcoplasmic reticula within the muscles, you know, you could make an argument that if you are like very glycogen depleted, you might be depleting the specific glycogen stores that are pretty close to the sarcoplasmic reticula, and it could have a negative impact on basically that cyclical necessary process of releasing and then resequestering that calcium cyclically during high velocity movements, especially with type 2 muscle fibers. So I would say you probably don't need to be, you know, carb loading like an endurance athlete by any means. I'm very confident that you don't need to do that. But I also wouldn't be too eager to go into training sessions like super glycogen depleted. So I would probably have some carbs in the diet if you can. But at the end of the day, I'm certain that there are people out there on kind of weightlifting focused programs like Olympic weightlifting who are on ketogenic diets, and I'm sure they do fine, right? It's not going to be a total make or break thing. But if I'm trying to optimize my, you know, velocity of muscle actions and my power output, it seems like you might as well have some carbs in the diet. You know, it doesn't have to be a high carb diet, but, you know, probably don't want to go extremely low. Okay, so Mike, I'm going to throw another training question at you here. Ooh, this is a good one. Right up your alley in your wheelhouse. So Josh Hall asked a question. What are your thoughts on doing like high velocity movements between sets with a different muscle group? So it sounds like maybe, you know, when you're training one muscle, you know, more traditional training, you know, few reps in reserve, you know, strength or hypertrophy focused. How do you feel about doing maybe like an antagonist superset, but focusing on just explosiveness, you know, either an antagonist muscle group or just a completely unrelated muscle group? What do you think about that strategy?
Yeah, so I think in general, and we've talked about this before on the podcast too, so agonist-antagonist supersets can be very beneficial. This is what I would call the champ of supersets, right? So if you're going to do a bench press and then a row or vice versa, the second exercise in that superset might actually benefit. So might actually get more reps than you otherwise would if you were just doing it as a traditional straight set. I'm not saying definitely, but the literature shows as a whole, at the very least, that's very time efficient and it does not impair performance. So I think that's a great strategy, a great way to go. Now, as I'm looking at this question, as I'm reading it, thoughts on doing velocity movements between sets. So that's kind of that superset work. I would also open that up and saying anytime you're doing anything with the antagonist muscle, that seems to be beneficial. Let me give you another example of this. In the interset stretching literature, which is, hey, if I stretch between sets, can this enhance hypertrophy? I kind of have a pessimistic view of that literature. I don't think it is overwhelmingly positive. I think it's neutral at best and detrimental for strength, because if you're doing a lot of stretching between sets, that's very fatiguing. It's going to decrease strength on the next set. However, antagonist stretching does seem to be beneficial. Now, I know this isn't high velocity. There's only two or three studies to my knowledge on antagonist muscle stretching. So if you're bench pressing, you know, stretching the lats, or if you're doing rows, stretching the chest, that actually seems to be beneficial for performance on the next set. And so that's a similar concept to that superset. So I do think antagonist movements between sets can be beneficial. Now, high velocity. So let me take that. I don't know if this is exactly what Josh is getting at, but if I cover this, then I think we've covered everything that I think he could be getting at. So high velocity would be something for just a few reps that's pretty explosive. So let's say maybe jump squats in between sets of the bench press, or Smith machine bench press bar throws in between sets of something else, or explosive push-ups in between sets of rows or something like that. I think if it's an antagonist, it's a good thing. However, the one caveat I would give to that is if you're going to do something that's explosive, like jump squats, that is maybe kind of systemically fatiguing. And that systemic fatigue could not have the beneficial effect that the agonist-antagonist movements do, and perhaps cause a bit of peripheral fatigue for whatever exercise you're going to do next. Even if it's an antagonist movement to the other muscle you're working, perhaps explosive push-ups for, you know, rows are a bit too fatiguing just because of the explosion that's going in there. So I might be a bit more cautious about that just because I haven't seen as much data on it, and stick to a more traditional agonist-antagonist superset. But that's kind of just an opinion on my part. Just thinking about it here quickly, not something I'm really basing on data. So take that last part for whatever it's worth, Josh.
All right, good stuff. Let's see here. We've got a question from Giacomo. Do we think that PDCAAS, protein digestibility corrected amino acid score, is something one should consider when choosing protein sources, or should we just shoot for a daily total protein intake? You're in luck. Good news. If you check out the Mass Research Review, we have covered that question in depth, and we've also covered it on previous episodes of this particular podcast in some way, shape, or form. So the short answer is I wouldn't really worry about it much at all. I mean, if you're getting enough total daily protein intake, the research lately seems to indicate that you should be in great shape, even with some pretty low quality proteins making up a decent chunk of your diet. So this is a topic near and dear to my heart. I eat, for all intents and purposes, a vegan diet. I have some eggs and dairy sparingly, but pretty much vegan. So the vast majority of the protein sources I'm, you know, getting are relatively low on that scale. And, you know, the literature would indicate it just doesn't really seem to matter all that much, as long as you're not consistently missing out on one specific essential amino acid, right? So if you're perpetually falling short with your methionine intake, that's going to be a problem. But most people, I should rephrase that, very few people find themselves in that situation when they have access to a variety of foods. You know, it's very unusual to find yourself in a position where you're gravitating toward one very specific, relatively low quality protein and ending up in that situation. So for example, you look at a lot of the dishes in, you know, vegetarian heavy cuisines or meals that just don't have meat. You think of like the classic rice and beans dish, right? Those are complementary proteins that kind of make up for each other. So, you know, those types of combinations really help hedge against the risk of being perpetually deficient in one specific essential amino acid. There was another nutrition question I wanted to get to here. It was a sleep one. Oh, it's both nutrition and sleep. So we had a question about creatine and sleep quality. So this individual saw some discussion regarding the effect of creatine on sleep quality. Is there any solid evidence regarding this? The last time I looked into this, it was a couple years ago. But this is a really interesting question because there seems to be a lot of like internet forum chatter where some small percentage of people says like, hey, whenever I'm on creatine, I can't sleep a wink. And I can't really wrap my head around mechanistically why that would be. And there is no good evidence related to this. It's kind of unsurprising. No one's really bothered to go out and say, hey, we're going to do a really sleep-focused study on creatine. It's not intuitively a hypothesis you would generate based on how creatine works. But I will acknowledge, I've seen people say this. It's an anecdote that, for whatever reason, has some degree of momentum behind it. I've personally never noticed such a thing. The vast majority of people fail to notice that. But I will say this. If you're someone who is sleeping like crap and you think creatine is causing it, try ditching the creatine and see if it fixes your sleep. And if it does, I'm strongly of the opinion that sleeping well is way more impactful and way more advantageous than being on creatine. So if you do anecdotally find yourself in that position and you have to choose between creatine or sleeping well, choose sleeping well literally 100% of the time. The magnitude of impact is just on a completely different scale, in my opinion. Let's see here. Someone thanked us for our service. That's a pretty serious way to address a podcaster. Yeah, Mike. Mike, I can't hear you. I don't know what's going on. Are you muted for somehow?
I am.
Okay.
Here I am. I was typing to Josh in the chat, and last time I typed on the episode, and you chastised me in front of the viewers.
Well, here's the thing, Mike. Here's the thing. If we have to change literally anything about the episode, like even just like trimming a gap at the beginning or the end, then the live chat does not show up on the replay. So it means that all of your efforts they're not wasted, but they are only reaching the people who happen to read it in real time.
Got it.
So I'm trying to help you, and all I get is disrespect. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. Hey, hey, Lauren. Yeah, could you host next week? I can't. Oh, there's a real call. It was a real call from her right now. She said, says she's in, and because I'm not gonna deal with this anymore. So on the individual that thanked us for our service, I noticed that Daniel said regarding the NS study, which, if anyone is not familiar, is a recent study that came out where they worked up to 52 sets per week on quads toward the end of the study, and said, how much muscle growth did they actually find in their 12-week study for higher sets? So if you're in mass, I did a video review of this study and also compared it to some other higher volume work back in Volume 7, Issue 11. So this was November of 2023, so fairly recently. And so I have that up in front of me. I saw this question. And so in terms of the muscle growth that they have here, in the 52 set per week group, and again, this was only 52 sets per week, I believe, in the last couple weeks of the 10 sets. They started at 22 sets. All groups started at 22 sets. They ended up with an 11% increase in vastus lateralis cross-sectional area, about a 10% increase in vastus lateralis cross-sectional area in the 42 set per week, so pretty much the same, and a 4% increase in the 22 set. It should also be noted that one individual actually lost 3.9% muscle in the 52 set per week group, because there is that individual response rate. I pulled up one of our other papers where we measured muscle growth in a regular 6-week training study in well-trained individuals. And in all of the groups here, they tended to add, depending on what we were looking at on the anterior quad, between 10 and 13% on the groups I'm looking at, and up to 15%, between 10 and 15% in the groups I'm looking at for chest muscle thickness. So fairly comparable. So it's not that NS saw some sort of crazy magnitude of gains here in this study. If I go back to the Abe study, which had up to 24 sets per week, they had about up to 7.5% increase in muscle in their highest group. If I look at Brigato, it was pretty similar. Schoenfeld high volume study, up to 45 sets, seemed to be similar-ish. So again, when I look at all of those, it's not a crazy amount of muscle growth that they saw. Things did tend to trend in the direction of the 52 sets, let's say, but it wasn't significant and there wasn't some overarching benefit for it there. And again, it was only 52 sets in the last couple weeks of the study, not the entire time. But to answer the question directly, for vastus lateralis cross-sectional area, the mean change percentage was 11%.
Good stuff. I'll tell you what, Mike, it's almost 8:30. I'm sleepy. I'm currently, my wife's out of town. I'm solo parenting a sick cat. She's fine. She'll be okay, but she has an upset tummy and she's wearing a cone. And so I'm chasing her around the house, dealing with, a new food protocol, drug timing. You got to give the antibiotic at a different time than the probiotic. It's a whole thing. So all of that is to say, I got to go chase this cat around. I love this cat dearly. I'm going to nurse her back to health. And then hopefully my wife will get home and take some of the pressure off me. But I know everyone right now that has like four kids is like, give me a break. I don't care. This is a lot for me. But anyway, it's about time to wrap up. There are some really great questions in the chat that I'm going to kind of jot down for next week. So Nuke Sploder has a great question about predictors of muscle growth. I think next week we'll probably get to that one. There was also one I saw about the minimum effective dose of training for muscle retention and, what's the minimum protein needed to preserve muscle during weight loss. There's a really great question by JBJ. So there's a couple good ones in here that I'm going to jot down and encourage everyone to tune in next week. We'll be live again Wednesday night. So be sure to come back in 1 week from today at 7 p.m. I forget when the time change happens. It might be between this episode and that episode. So if that's the case, just double check your world clock. We're going to be on New York City time, whenever that happens to be, 7 p.m. next Wednesday. One final piece of business before we go. We have a very troubling observation here. The number of viewers is higher than the number of likes, which means one of two things. Either people very much don't like the show, or they forgot to hit the like button. So if the latter is true, make sure you hit the like button on your way out. It helps us keep the lights on around here, and we very much appreciate it. So, Mike, do you have anything to say to the good people before we sign off?
Two things. One, I have the job of being the assistant baseball coach for the Cooper City, Florida U8 Phillies. That's not just a job anybody can get. You have to fill out the light blue form, not the turquoise form. Otherwise, they push you to the back of the line. We're off to a decent start this season. Number 8 in your programs, number 1 in your hearts. Zachary Zordos is 3-for-9 on the year, hitting .333 with 2 RBI so far. We'll see if he can keep it up. The league keeps stats for the 8-year-old. That's a serious thing. They send them to us. It's insane, but it's fun. And lastly, and most importantly, thank you to every single person for dropping into Office Hours. I am truly floored every time I'm on the show about how many people are here, how many great questions there are. It is a pleasure to do this and to be able to connect with everybody here. So thank you so much for your support. It means a great deal.
Yeah, I want to echo that. I won't share the exact metric, but the total number of people who dropped in during the live episode was greater than 100 and less than 100,000. So it's somewhere in that range and continues to climb. So we appreciate your support. And Mike, I've actually been watching a lot of baseball lately. I've been going to the Duke games because the Duke baseball stadium is right by my office. So I'll go there and actually just do some work and kind of have the ambiance of a baseball game in the background. And normally it's nice and relaxing and fun, but man, the last game I went to was crazy. I'll put it this way. Someone hit a 3-run home run. A Duke player hit a 3-run home run and a grand slam in the same inning. They put up 16 runs in an inning. And yeah, it was fireworks. I think that they almost batted around twice in that inning. It was insane. So Duke, they've got a hell of a team this year. Last I checked, they were ranked number 12. They lost one silly little game in a 3-game series that they won. But yeah, they have one loss and a bunch of wins. And every now and then the bats just go crazy and they've got a couple games now where they've put up 20 something runs. And the season is young. So I'm like a big college baseball guy now out of nowhere.
Like this new introduction to your life. That's awesome. Yeah. Sounds like this guy was going for the home run cycle, if that's a thing in the game.
Yeah. He was going for something. It was funny too, because, I always get a kick out of like sport-specific lingo when a sport develops its own culture and then has this like very insular kind of like terminology. And this guy comes up to bat, the guy who hit the 2 home runs, and he had already hit a grand slam this inning. He comes up again, and some guy kind of peers over to these people on the other side of me, and they said, "Is this guy batting .459?" His thing was on the scoreboard, and they go, "Yeah." And he goes, "This kid rakes," and then he hits a 3-run home run the next pitch, and I was like, "Yeah, he rakes, man."
That's the definition of raking.
He rakes, absolutely. Yeah. So, a couple homers and 7 RBIs in an inning, not too bad. And yeah, the kid's probably hitting .500 now. So, anyway, I don't think anyone needs more Duke baseball updates until the College World Series kicks off. But on that note, if you're a college basketball fan, Duke UNC Saturday night or Saturday at some point, it's going to be crazy. Hope you all enjoy it as much as I do. Thanks to everyone so much for joining us. Appreciate the support. We'll be back in exactly 1 week with another episode of Mass Office Hours, brought to you by the Mass Research Review. If you want to learn more about it, go to massresearchreview.com.